Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Lewis, Longman & Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Governor Rick Scott pushes for annual agency head performance reviews, but what shape those reviews will take is going to have to wait until a later meeting.
We don't want to create metrics that become the ceiling instead of the floor, where we're doing, you know, management by checklists.
Also tonight, the Florida Senate picks Florida Health Choices as its vehicle to pull down federal dollars for low-income folks without health insurance, but there are still questions.
How is this entity that Florida has never really used, supposed to now manage up to 800,000 people?
We'll also follow the debate about whether the search for state university president should be conducted in the shade, look at possible changes to Florida's Bright Futures scholarships, and revisit the question of unanimous jury decisions in capital cases. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capital Report. The Florida Cabinet squared off again today on the issue of reviewing and or replacing agency leaders. Nick Evans reports much of Governor Rick Scott's plan was either thrown out or put off to a later date.
It's been a rocky few months for Florida Governor Rick Scott's administration. After controversy surrounding the departure of former Department of Law Enforcement Chief Gerald Bailey, his office has stumbled through attempts at developing a process for regularly reviewing cabinet appointees. At the February cabinet meeting in Tampa, Scott conceded Bailey's ouster was mishandled, which, while refreshing for an elected official, was marred somewhat by Scott doubling down on his actions.
Before I open up for discussion, I want to add that searching for new leadership is often important to bring in new energy and fresh ideas. In fact, we have made changes all across state government as part of a transition to a second term.
Later at that meeting, Scott tried to push a new process for annual review to a vote, but he faced pushback from fellow cabinet members and parliamentary procedure itself. The idea wasn't properly noticed as an action item, so a formal vote was put off. Then last week at the cabinet aides meeting, Scott's deputies came with a fully developed rubric for judging the performance of three agency leaders. At this meeting, aides for the other three cabinet members raised a number of objections. Robert Tornillo from CFO Jeff Atwater's office argues it's too soon to vote on Scott's performance metrics.
Right. You've got to get to this point first.
Seems premature. Yeah.
Before you start even looking at performance measures, I feel like we're trying to do something before we even have a process in place.
Wednesday, the cabinet met to discuss the proposals. CFO Jeff Atwater and Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam pushed back on a central plank of Scott's plan: an annual review for every agency appointee where cabinet members can vote to remove them.
My experiences, life experiences, have been in the private sector. I had my annual review and I understood where I stood. I didn't pick up and relocate the family knowing that there would be a public vote on whether I stayed or left every year.
Atwater has continually voiced concerns about attracting talent with an annual vote hanging over their head. He successfully got language to that effect removed. But it must be said, striking the point is a largely symbolic change. Putnam points out the cabinet can still bring department leadership to a vote at any time.
If it were removed from consideration, I would not be concerned that we have lost oversight. I would not be concerned that we could not remove someone who is failing to perform, and I would not be concerned that we could not reward someone who is an outstanding leader.
Atwater also expressed concern about the governor's performance metrics. He says the cabinet should begin a dialogue with agency officials before determining how they'll be judged.
What they see as their highest priorities, sticking with their mission, value to taxpayer, this is what we think you should be measuring us. I take the time in between the next two meetings to put my best thoughts, like you have, on paper. We may want to say, okay, by the next meeting after that, which may be early April, mid-April, whichever one that is, we would hope to come to a conclusion.
In the end, Governor Scott tabled metrics until a later date. The current plan calls for appointees to speak with the cabinet two meetings from now, with the goal of developing a rubric by the following meeting. This pushes the issue into the summer and could keep the controversy surrounding Bailey's ouster alive. But speaking after Wednesday's meeting, the governor struck an optimistic tone.
Well, I think we had a good conversation today about a process, and I think we'll continue to work through, starting with three agencies, and we'll continue to work through those agencies, and I think we're going to have a great process.
Those first three agencies are the Office of Insurance Regulation, the Office of Financial Regulation, and the Department of Revenue. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
A busy day at the Florida legislature when it comes to, dare we call it, Medicaid expansion. Lynn Hatter, you've been following this since just about the beginning.
Yeah, and in the beginning, you may remember something called Negron Care. That was the bill put forth by Republican Senator Joe Negron that called for Florida pulling down $50 billion in federal funds and steering the Medicaid expansion population into privately managed plans. Well, today we found out what exactly that's going to look like, and Florida is going to use, as proposed under the Senate, its Florida Health Choices Marketplace to basically administer this program.
Now, would this mean that Florida would be able to pull down the same kind of federal funding that other states have been able to do through the Affordable Care Act?
Theoretically, yes. So Florida Health Choices, we maybe remember, was created in 08, right before the federal government passed the Affordable Care Act. And it never quite got off the ground. The Florida legislature told it, you know, you can have nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act. And so most people right now go shopping on the federal insurance exchange. Well, Florida Health Choices has three employees. And one of the big questions is, how is this entity that Florida has never really used, supposed to now manage up to 800,000 people? Well, Republican Senator Aaron Bean seems to think that it can. And so this would become the expansion vehicle, and Florida Healthy Kids, which is basically the program that assists Medicaid-eligible children, would eventually be folded into Florida Health Choices. This also comes with a lot of caveats. So people would have to work or be looking for work. There are premiums and co-pays that they would have to pay. And so some of the questions involve, well, can people who are at or below the federal poverty level even, you know, afford to pay the $3 co-pay? Some people say yes. Some people say no.
This is what's going on now in the Senate. What is happening in the House relative to this? Anything?
Oh, in the House, probably nothing right now. I did talk to Senator Bean after the committee. I asked him whether or not they were having conversations, and he said, yes, there are conversations. Where they're going appears to be nowhere very fast. And I say that because the House is really holding out for negotiations over something called the low-income pool, which is up to $2 billion of state and federal funding that reimburses hospitals for treating low-income patients. That goes away this year. The federal government has said repeatedly it's not interested in renewing it, but yet it's included in the House budget, and it's included in the governor's budget. And actually, interestingly, today, Senator Don Gates said anybody who could say, and I'm paraphrasing here, that we should keep the LIT program but reject Medicaid expansion is basically being intellectually dishonest, which is basically taking a swipe at the governor and at the House, which, you know, the House has repeatedly refused to expand Medicaid. So this could potentially be a big, big, big point of contention between the House and between the Senate. We're already hearing, you know, the possibility of a special session. But the Senate is serious about this.
And here we are, just about midpoint in the second week of the 60-day legislative session. And once again, we're talking about Medicaid expansion and that divide between the Florida Senate and the Florida House. And somewhere in betwixt and between there is Governor Rick Scott. We'll just have to keep riding herd on it and see what happens. Lynn Hatter of Florida Public Radio keeping us up to date on what's going on as far as Medicaid expansion goes in the Florida legislature.
It's only the beginning, Tom, and we still have 6 weeks left.
A House panel tomorrow is expected to take up a proposal that would revamp the state's red light camera law, including the possibility of banning citations for drivers who make right-hand turns.
The House Highway and Waterway Safety Subcommittee will consider a bill that would change a 2010 state red light camera law, along with placing a prohibition on citations for right-hand turns. The bill also calls for restrictions on how local governments can use money they receive from violations. Citations carry penalties of $158, with local governments receiving $75 and the rest going to state programs. Under the bill, the local portion would have to be spent on public safety initiatives, which could include the costs of red light camera programs. The bill would also include other changes, such as requiring that violation notices be sent by certified mail rather than the current first-class mail. Still to come on Capitol Report, few lawmaking sessions take place without at least one more substance being declared an illegal drug, and it looks like this year is no exception.
This is a step in the right direction in terms of not sending people to prison for possession of a plant.
A bill to take university presidential searches behind closed doors passed a House committee today, despite the opposition of a lone Democrat, FSU faculty, and open government advocates.
30 days is an awful long time for a campaign, or, as I said, to smear someone if that's your intent.
Two bills pertaining to the Florida Bright Futures Scholarship passed the Higher Learning Committee with flying colors.
So by your vote, SB 960 is reported favorably.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment.
Several Florida lawmakers insist a supplement called Kratom should be classified as a Schedule I drug. But Regan McCarthy reports others argue there's not enough proof the drug is harmful and worry one more illegal substance could mean a whole bunch more people headed for jail.
Kratom is the dried leaf from a tropical tree native to Southeast Asia. Some, like Tom Harrison, a business owner in South Florida, say brewed kratom makes a stimulating tea.
I stand before you having just finished a cup of kratom tea. I drink kratom daily.
Harrison sells the herb and says he's careful not to sell to teens. But he says calling it a drug doesn't make sense. Meanwhile, David Scharf, executive director of community programs with the Broward Sheriff's Office, says kratom is a dangerous and addictive drug.
In South Florida, we have the unfortunate distinction of seeing many of the new designer drugs in the offshoots before the rest of Florida and other states. And our concern is the devastating effects some of these new readily available hallucinogenic drugs have on our citizens and in particular our young people.
Scharf says kratom has opiate effects and could impact users in unknown ways. Now lawmakers are moving forward with legislation to make it illegal in Florida. But some, like Lake Worth Democratic Senator Jeff Clemons, worry the state's racking up too many potential felonies, which Clemons says means too many nonviolent offenders heading to prison. He proposed changing the bill during a Senate Criminal Justice Committee to make kratom possession a misdemeanor instead of a felony.
I still have some reservations about it being a Schedule I drug, but before this meeting was kind of unable to come up with an alternative that we feel legally fits the correct definitions. At the very least, I think that this is a step in the right direction in terms of not sending people to prison for possession of a plant.
The committee okayed the Clemons Amendment, but some lawmakers, like St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis, say they haven't seen any evidence indicating possession of kratom should be a crime.
I'm not going to support the bill today. I might have supported it if we were going to make it for those under 18 and then we're going to give them a civil citation. That might have honored got my support. But as the bill is drawn, look, there hasn't been a compelling case that this raises to some level of an important issue.
But Coconut Creek Democratic Representative Kristen Jacobs argues people have become addicted and even died from using kratom.
So when folks come up to you today and they tell you that it's a plant, I would point out to you that so are cocaine leaves and so are poppy seeds.
Jacobs presented the bill in Tuesday's Senate committee. She's sponsoring the bill in the House. The Senate bill passed the committee with a 3-2 vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Fallout from the appointment of Florida State University President John Thrasher continued today as a House panel voted to take the academic recruiting process behind closed doors. As Jim Ash reports, Democrats, FSU faculty, and open government advocates are strongly opposed to making the process secret.
Representative Neil Comey, a Republican from Polk County, isn't sure whether Florida's public records laws scare away potential university presidents, provosts, or deans. But it's possible some candidates don't want their job search advertised, he says. And there's a more fundamental reason for shutting the public out of the search process, he says.
And another thing, universities in Florida, in this system, are not democratic institutions.
That dumbfounds Jennifer Proffitt, president of the Florida State University chapter of the United Faculty of Florida.
I'm not really sure what else to say because I don't think I've processed that yet.
Proffitt, an associate dean of communications, says the notion is a stab to her heart.
The whole reason why we have a public education system so that people are well-informed.
During the FSU presidential search this summer, it was an open secret that former House Speaker John Thrasher had a lock on the job. An alum and former House Speaker, Thrasher sold himself as a top-notch fundraiser. Speculation grew when the AP requested emails from a search consultant. In one, he urged a quick vote on Thrasher to avoid the appearance of a sham. Nobody would have known that under Comey's bill, warns First Amendment Foundation President Barbara Peterson.
Because of our open government laws, we learned that Thrasher had not even applied at that point in time.
The bill shields the names of applicants. The original version made finalists public record 10 days before the winner is selected. The latest version of the bill extends that to 30 days. Comey says that's plenty of time for the public to make its voice heard.
30 days is an awful long time for a campaign or, as I said, to smear someone if that's your intent.
Academics talk about their career moves all the time and wouldn't be afraid of applying elsewhere, Peterson says. She's worried about the message the bill sends.
It also presumes that the university presidents and college deans that we've appointed since 1967 are not the best they could be.
Anyone who doubts the public interest in the university presidential searches should talk to 61-year-old Howard Stewart. He drove from Daytona Beach to Tallahassee for the committee hearing.
I've been a little bit concerned about Florida's beginning to get a little bit of a reputation for the politicization of higher education, which concerns me.
Comey's bill has two more committee stops before reaching the floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Two proposed policy changes to the Florida Bright Futures Scholarship Program passed unanimously today. Matthew Seeger breaks down those changes to the lottery-funded program.
The Florida Bright Futures Scholarship is a program funded by the Florida Lottery. It covers the college or university tuition of students who meet certain academic requirements. Another eligibility requirement for the scholarship is a certain amount of community service hours. Individual school boards can decide how many hours that amounts to, and Republican Senator Tom Lee sees a bit of a problem with that.
And as a result, we have 67 different counties applying the law very differently.
The senator from Hillsborough's proposal was to streamline things by standardizing the hours statewide. He also included other options on how to count those hours, such as internships with local businesses or working under a candidate for office.
The Graham Research Center, as well as the Lou Frey Research Center, did a report back a couple years ago that essentially concluded that Florida's youth, the millennials, are so much less engaged in civic and political activities in the state of Florida than most other states in the nation.
That bill passed the vote 9-0 and goes into effect in July. The second bill was pushed by Democratic Senator Bill Monfort of North Florida and took on a provision within Bright Futures that allows students who, following their graduation, choose to serve religiously or militarily and then run up against inflexible deadlines. Before the amendment, Bright Futures only allowed students a period of 2 years to accept the award, then gave them a 5-year period to reapply. Those numbers have changed slightly, as Senator Monford explains.
Prior to 2010-11, those limits were 3 years following high school and 7 years following that you could renew during that time. 2010 and 11 and 11 and 12, we changed it to 3 years following high school graduation and 5 years following high school graduation for the renewal. And then in 12-13, we changed it once again to 2 years following high school graduation and then 5 years for the renewal.
The amendment will allow an exemption to the waiting period for those obligated students. This bill garnered several testimonials, such as that from Zach Lawson of Okaloosa, who took a missionary trip following his graduation. While Bright Futures didn't actually exist when he graduated and he never had to worry about the deadline, he testified in support of Senator Monford's bill regardless.
What this service did for me was I was able to go to South America for 2 years. And we go all over the world, from the United States to Australia. And so I was able to learn the Spanish language, learn how to deal with people socially, interact with many different people.
Someone whose missionary work was affected by the deadline was the son of Lynn Walquist from Bristol.
I'm here as a Latter-day Saint, but I'm here as a proponent of anybody that would choose to serve a mission that they would be able to come back and activate that. They've earned the scholarship, and it would allow them to go forward.
Neither of these bills needed much deliberation, and just like Lee's bill before it, this one passed the vote 9-0 and will take effect on the same date as the first bill. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Matthew Seeger.
A controversial bill that would allow designated employees or volunteers to carry guns at public schools is slated to get its first hearing tomorrow in the House. The K-12 subcommittee will consider the proposal, which supporters say would bolster school safety. Under the bill filed by Representative Greg Stube, Republican of Sarasota, a school superintendent could authorize a school safety designee to carry a concealed weapon on school property. The county school board would have to approve the superintendent appointing such a designee, who could be an honorably discharged military veteran, an active duty member of the military, National Guard or Reserves, or an active duty or former law enforcement officer. The designee would have to be licensed to carry a concealed weapon, complete a school safety program, and pass a background screening. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Now here's Ronald J. Eben with an advance look at tomorrow's legislative doings at the Capitol.
Funds to support Amendment Number 1 will be the issue before the Senate General Government Appropriations Subcommittee. The committee will consider a series of bills involving carrying out the constitutional amendment that will require the state to set aside money for land and water conservation. The Senate Health and Human Services Appropriations Subcommittee will receive information from State Surgeon General John Armstrong about the Children's Medical Services and Early Steps programs. The Department of Health recently laid off administrators of the program, which serves babies and toddlers with developmental disabilities. The Senate Education Pre-K-12 Committee will hold a workshop on a series of bills that deal with charter schools or school choice. Smoking in cars will be targeted in the Senate Regulated Industries Committee. A bill by Senator Jeff Clemens would be considered. It would prohibit people from smoking in vehicles when children under the age of 13 are present. The House is scheduled for a floor session at 4 Wednesday afternoon. Florida Commission on Offender Review will consider numerous parole cases involving crimes committed in the 1970s and 1980s. Those are some of the items up for consideration at the Capitol tomorrow. I'm Ronald J. Evans.
Finally tonight, unless you've been convicted of a crime and sentenced to a Florida prison, you probably haven't been inside one of these facilities. Although he's no criminal, Reggie Garcia has seen 29 Florida prisons from the inside. Garcia is a Tallahassee-based attorney specializing in clemency and parole cases. Most of his clients are behind bars, and he believes inmates can be roughly divided into three general categories.
You know, they say one-third are already planning the next crime because they know no other life. That's sad but true.
Then there are those who have already been pretty much scared straight.
one-third are in there for relatively non-serious felonies like minor drug possession or property crimes, might be in there for 3, 4, 5 years. You know, it's said they're frightened they'll never get a speeding ticket when they get out.
As for the rest of the state's inmates?
The real challenge is the one-third in between that could go in either direction, depending on what kind of educational, vocational, spiritual courses they avail themselves of while they're incarcerated, which largely dictates on whether they're employable when they get out.
Meanwhile, Garcia thinks the last thing a corrections facility should be is a cradle for more criminality.
Inmate on inmate, violence with gangs, and particularly alleged officers engaging in suspicious behavior and potentially violence against inmates, which have been in the news. Those are new felonies. Those are new crimes.
Which includes the criminal culture of contraband.
Every cell phone that's in prison is there illegally. Any drugs, any alcohol, any cash. And it's unfortunate, but those types of things require complicity or active participation by dishonest guards. And once all of those things are in the system, then those become the currency for inmates and some guards to run underground economies in the prisons, which then sometimes lead to the violence we're hearing about.
Garcia thinks making sure correctional officers are well-trained, ethical, and properly compensated would go a long way.
By and large, you have dedicated officers on the front line. Many are working 10 and 12-hour shifts when maybe 8 makes more sense. Sometimes there's 2 or 3 people in a dorm when it needs to be 4 or 5. So by all means, paying them better, training them better, and having more guards is certainly part of the solution.
Meanwhile, Garcia likes what he sees happening in the legislature.
I applaud the legislature, particularly the Senate, has now passed a major reform bill out of 2 committees.
And he thinks the new secretary at the Department of Corrections is a positive move as well.
I commend the governor. I think his appointment in November, December of Julie Jones, who we all know in Tallahassee as a former law enforcement officer at Game and Fish, but also more recently 5 years running the Department of Highway Safety, which is the parent agency for the Florida Highway Patrol. I think Secretary Jones and particularly some of the Senate leaders are looking at reforms. They don't look like they're agreeing and matching up on just about everything. I think it'll be a work in progress.
An important work for a system that incarcerates more than 100,000 people and supervises an equal number outside of prison walls. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Evan, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Matthew Seeger. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again each weeknight during the 2015 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Lewis, Longman & Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.